Support for KQED comes from Xfinity. Customers can get wall-to-wall Wi-Fi that extends coverage throughout the home. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary. On a new episode of The Porter, Junior finds himself in debt to notorious Chicago gangster Miss Queenie. Lucy's new relationship impacts her career, and Marlene makes an unlikely friend. Tune in to The Porter tomorrow night at 9 on KQED+. The producers, reporters, and hosts of KQED Public Radio are represented by the Screen Actors Guild, American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, AFL-CIO. Sunshine tomorrow, highs from the low 60s to the low to mid 80s, 83 for Livermore and Walnut Creek's high, same for San Jose, 72 expected in San Francisco. I'm Sandy Althaus and this is KQED-FM San Francisco and KQEI-FM North Highlands, Sacramento, 11 p.m.
Hello and welcome to Newsday on the BBC World Service with Rob Young and Sana Safi.
It's 7 a.m. here in London, 9:30 in Iran, where the funeral service of the president, Ibrahim Raisi, is due to begin in the city of Tabriz. TV pictures show thousands of people already lining the streets. We will bring you the latest.
We hear from a former political prisoner and the spokesman for the campaign to free political prisoners in Iran.
And the WikiLeaks founder, Julian Assange, has won the right to challenge a request from the United States that he be extradited there. We'll speak to his wife.
And George Addo will have sport and Saranjana Tiwari will update us on the latest business stories making headlines. But first, the latest world news.
Hello, I'm Neil Nunes with the BBC News. Human rights groups have expressed concern about a trial due to start in Greece later of nine men accused of causing the biggest migrant shipwreck in the Mediterranean for a decade. It's thought more than 600 people drowned last June when an overcrowded boat sank. Nick Beek has this report.
The nine men on trial face life in prison if convicted of people smuggling and causing a shipwreck. The Greek prosecution's case directly contradicts the Greek Coast Guard's highly contentious claim from last summer that the boat was safe and so not in need of rescue. At least six survivors have since told the BBC the Coast Guard themselves capsized the boat in a botched effort to tow it. The Greek Coast Guard has repeatedly denied that it caused the migrant boat to sink, interfered with witnesses, or attempted a cover-up.
An investigation by leading international news organizations has found that the European Union is financing operations by North African governments to detain thousands of migrants and dump them in remote areas. The reports say EU funds were used to train units involved in Tunisia, Morocco and Mauritania. The European Commission has previously denied sponsoring the mistreatment of migrants in North Africa. Funeral ceremonies for the Iranian president Ibrahim Raisi are about to start in the city of Tabriz, near the place where he died in a helicopter crash on Sunday. We get more from Liz Doucette.
Iran's farewell to its president and seven others who died in Sunday's crash will unfold over a few days and in cities across the country. Iranian officials say there have been requests from so many people in so many provinces who want to participate in the funeral procession. Tomorrow, Iran's supreme leader, 85-year-old Ayatollah Khamenei, will preside over the ceremony in the capital, Tehran. This week of mourning will be the first test for Iran's conservative leaders who want to send a clear and convincing signal of continuity.
The first of two Australian military planes has landed in New Caledonia to evacuate citizens stranded by violent unrest in the French Pacific Territory. New Zealand has sent another. There's been a week of rioting sparked by electoral changes. Here's Katie Watson.
The French High Commission says that on Thursday it will reassess a decision to open the airport. In the meantime, France has flown in more than 1,000 extra police to boost security in the French overseas territory. More officers are on their way. The French High Commission has also said it's tried to take back control of the road from the capital, Noumea, to the airport. But the Australian government has issued travel advice warning that the route is not yet safe. Since unrest began last week, 4 civilians have been killed and 2 police officers.
BBC News. Commercial flights have resumed at Haiti's international airport nearly 3 months after it was closed due to gang-related violence wracking the country. A single Sunrise Airways flight left the capital, Port-au-Prince, for Miami, Florida. More flights are expected later in the week. The alleged ringleaders of a far-right plot to overthrow the German government are due to go on trial in Frankfurt today. The suspects have been linked to the so-called Reichsbürger movement that rejects the post-war German state. Here's Jessica Parker.
This is the highest profile of 3 trials linked to what investigators say was a plan to enter the German parliament, arrest MPs, and violently establish a new order across the country. Prosecutors say the group had access to a massive arsenal of weapons and about €500,000. Much attention will focus on a man known as Heinrich XIII Prince Royce. He's a 72-year-old former real estate developer, descended from German aristocracy, who, it's said, had been earmarked as the interim head of state.
Microsoft has unveiled what it's described as the next generation of Windows PCs, with built-in hardware and software tools to leverage the power of artificial intelligence. The world's most valuable company calls it Copilot Plus. Microsoft says it can process AI features directly on the computer, doing away with paid subscriptions and the external processing of data. Mexico's Environment Agency is investigating a spate of deaths among wild howler monkeys that's been linked to a severe heat wave in the southern states of Tabasco and Chiapas. Temperatures of up to 45 Celsius have recently been recorded. Conservationists have been patrolling forested areas to provide food and water to animals in distress. BBC News.
Thank you for their news. Welcome to Newsday. Rob Yang and Sana Safi with you. This half hour, 5 days of mourning and funeral ceremonies for the Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi. We will speak to our colleague at BBC Persian. And we hear why Hollywood actress Scarlett Johansson is not happy with ChatGPT. As ever, you can send us your thoughts on anything you hear on this program. Our text and WhatsApp number is +44 77 86 20 50 85.
Well, we start in Iran, where a funeral procession is beginning for the president, Ibrahim Raisi, who, with 7 others, were killed in a helicopter crash on Sunday. A funeral procession is getting underway in the northwestern city of Tabriz. We're watching TV pictures here in the studio, which show thousands of people filling the streets. Some are waving Iranian flags, others are holding pictures of the president and some of the others who were killed in that crash aloft. With us in the studio is BBC Persian special correspondent Kazra Naji. Welcome to the studio. We can hear there some of the sound of that funeral procession. Just talk us through what is taking place.
That's the recitation of Quran, which is normal in this kind of ceremonies, funeral ceremonies. What we are witnessing is tens of thousands, probably, in Tabriz, which is the center of the province of East Azerbaijan in Iran, in northwest of Iran. This is near where the crash happened. And today is the informal, if you like, ceremony for the 8 people who died, the president, the foreign minister, and 6 others, including 3 crew members. So that's going to be an informal funeral procession. What we are expecting is basically speeches from various officials, recitations of Quran, and probably a procession of the coffins of the 8 people. But the big funeral is scheduled for tomorrow in Tehran, the capital. And we are expecting Iran's supreme leader to be there. For today, this is basically Iranian officials, Iranian regime, trying to sort of give the 8 proper, send-off ceremony, but at the same time, rally people around the regime use that emotions that this death of these eight people have generated.
So we're on the second of 5 days of mournings. Yeah. So does that mean everybody's off work?
In Tabriz it might be the case, but generally across the country there are 5 days of mourning, and tomorrow, Wednesday, is going to be a national holiday.
Now, the news of Ibrahim Raisi's death was met with, yes, sorrow by some people, but also celebrations by others. We were hearing earlier on in the programme about the record he had in the 80s of his role in ordering the execution of thousands of people. But there are huge numbers of people here on the streets of Tabriz. Would that in any way be organized, or will those people feel that they want to be there?
Well, these are the supporters of the hardliners in Iran. And the hardliners generally are accepted that they have the support of about 10-15% of the population, probably at most 20%. And these are the people who are supporters of those hardline people. These are the part of that 15%, 20%, 10%. And the people who have invested in the regime and support for the regime. The rest of the country is not going to be appearing in these ceremonies. They're not going to be there. And as of course, you know, there are the death of the president and the foreign minister and others has generated a lot of mixed emotions in Iran. And there are many people in Iran who don't support the regime. They don't feel particularly hurt by this thing, by this event. And they're not going to be seen here giving support to the regime, because this kind of rallies are used by Iranian regime to project support from within the country.
And you said earlier on it's about projecting strength as well. Yet we have the president, the foreign minister and others killed in a helicopter due to a technical problem, we're told by state media. This helicopter was American. It wasn't able to get new correct parts from America because of Western sanctions. And the succession now for the top job in the country to be supreme leader is now in crisis because it was the president who was being lined up to take the job. So it is not in any way really able, surely, to project a position of strength to the population.
A position of strength may not be the case, but they are trying to give the impression that there will be continuity, there will be instability. Iran's supreme leader has been speaking about that, saying that there won't be any disruptions, the security of the country will be held together. But obviously this won't be the case. There will be disruption. Of course, we don't have a president who's the head of the government, and the elections are scheduled for June the 28th in about 6 weeks' time. Until then, I suspect a lot of the work of the government will be on hold for the time being until the outcome of the elections and the appointment of a new president. Today, as we're speaking, there is the opening of the experts assembly. That is an assembly that is given the job of it has a constitutional role and the job of finding a successor for the supreme leader who's 85 years old. And today they opened that assembly because they had the elections about a couple of months ago.
It was scheduled to open today anyway, I think, wasn't it?
It was scheduled, and they have opened it, and there's a sort of an empty chair for President Raisi, who was the vice president of that experts assembly.
And just looking at these TV pictures from Iran in the city of Tabriz, there are these thousands and thousands of men. I think it is only men there. Can you tell from your...
No, there will be women too. But they are separated.
Right. And they're all currently standing still. Will they then process through the city?
I don't know what the plan is, but I suspect at one point there will be, they bring in the coffins of the eight people, and that coffin will be sort of moved through the crowd, and possibly some crowd will follow the coffin.
Kazra Naji, BBC Persian special correspondent for now. Thanks very much indeed.
For more, let's speak now with Shiva Mahbubi, who knows about Mr. Raisi's policies firsthand. She's a former political prisoner and the spokeswoman for the campaign to free political prisoners in Iran. Welcome to Newsday, Shiva John. First of all, how do you react to the death of President Ebrahim Raisi?
I think, like millions of people in Iran, I am very happy. Of course, I wanted to see Raisi in a court of justice internationally to be trialed for the crime he committed for more than four decades. But obviously, as you see the reaction from Iran, I know there are scenes on the TV today that showing that some people are mourning. I must say that I disagree with your previous interviewees. I think people who are supporting the regime, they are even less than 5%. And these are people who are on the payroll, basically, of the regime. So therefore, I think I must say that Raisi for us people in Iran associates with being a murderer, because he started his basically first role in 1980. That means more than 40 years ago, and then continued having in judiciary, in prosecution. And what I want to emphasize for your listener, being in prosecution or being in judiciary doesn't mean what we have here. That means that he issued basically arrest warrant, kidnapping millions of people, including 13 years old, 12 years old, because I was myself in prison once when I was 12 and once I was 16 years old. Many of my prison mates were actually executed in the summer of 1988. 36 years ago, in the summer of 1988, he was the member of a death committee. He ordered the execution of more than 5,000 political prisoners only in 3 weeks. So he is called a butcher of Tehran for the right reason. And also in the woman life movement, in woman life freedom movement and protest, he was in charge and he was emphasizing and reinforcing the morality police to kill women, to basically suppress them. So as you can see, consistency, Raisi been suppressing, been impacted the life of people, millions of people, those families who lost their kids in the 1988 massacre. They are still, after 36 years, looking for the grave of their loved one, and they're still threatened up to this day. Mm-hmm. So you can see people were, I'm really sad that this is not shown on TV and on the news, that people were having fireworks last night, because they were happy that this murderer has died.
You mentioned that you went to jail twice. Can you tell us why you were jailed?
Well, I was, the first time when I was 12, we were demonstrating for reopening our school, and many of our
Shiva, can you hear
something? Second time again, I was in the.
So the first time round, you were demonstrating to reopen your schools, because when the mullahs took over, they shut down schools for girls. Is that
absolutely
what?
Absolutely. And the second time, I was still, I mean, I was in demonstration as basic as that when I was 16 years old. I think it's important to see when you hear the name of Raisi, that is like you hear the name of Hitler. For us, and it's really interesting that when he was alive, he was welcomed in the UN by the international community, meaning the international organization and their government. And I think yesterday we heard that International Criminal Court prosecutors is seeking arrest for Netanyahu and Hamas leader. Islamic regime, if someone like Raisi actually created Hezbollah, funding Hamas, and they haven't been touched. And you can see that in, for example, in Syria, many high-ranking Assad's people were on trial under the principle of universal jurisdiction. But unfortunately, Raisi, to the end of his life, he was invited, he was accepted. How can a murderer who committed crime against humanity for more than 40 years can be welcomed in the UN and other countries? And that's what people want. They want whoever replaced Raisi, it really doesn't matter. Regime in Iran is a system, and they're all united in suppressing people, especially suppressing LGBTQ women and whoever are defying them, basically.
Shiva Mahbubi, thank you very much for joining us, a spokeswoman for the campaign to free political prisoners in Iran.
You're listening to Newsday from the BBC with Sana Safi and Rob Young. And George Addo has your sports headlines.
Yes, begin with NFL. And after 9 seasons, Philadelphia Eagles wide receiver Devante Parker has decided to retire. As much as he looked forward to his time with the Eagles, Parker has resolved to spend more time with his family. Football, and Arne Slot says the opportunity to work with one of the biggest clubs in the world was difficult to ignore, as he was confirmed as Liverpool's new head coach. The Reds agreed a compensation deal worth $11.4 million with Feyenoord in April, after the 45-year-old was identified as the man to succeed Jurgen Klopp at Anfield. In tennis, Dominic Thiem beat Franco Agamenone 3-6, 6-3, 6-2 in the first round of qualifying for the French Open in Paris. The former US Open champion, who will retire later this year, needs to win 2 more matches to reach the main draw of the Grand Slam. And in golf, Scottie Scheffler's court date has been delayed until the 3rd of June, following his arrest during the US PGA Championship at Valhalla last week. A 27-year-old was arrested after trying to drive into the golf club in heavy traffic, and his arraignment date had been set for Tuesday, the 21st of May. And that's your sport for now.
Cheers, George. Talk to you again in a bit.
Now, last week, OpenAI showed off its newest AI model called ChatGPT-4o. It has audio capabilities that let users speak to the chatbot and obtain real-time responses. But the platform has managed to upset a Hollywood star. Business presenter Suranjana Tiwari is here with us with the details. Suranjana, what is the story about?
That's right. The actor Scarlett Johansson has said she was left shocked and angered after OpenAI launched a chatbot with an eerily similar voice to her own. The actress said she had previously turned down an approach by the company to voice its new chatbot, which reads text aloud to users, as you just mentioned. And when the new model, which is called Sky, debuted last week, lots of commentators were quick to draw comparisons between the chatbot's tone and Johansson in the 2013 film Her, in which she plays a chat system, Samantha, who forms an intimate relationship with a human. OpenAI have said that it would remove the voice, but insisted that it was not meant to be an imitation of the star. Ms. Johansson has accused the company and its founder of deliberately copying her voice in a statement seen by the BBC.
So she has revealed a lot in the statement. What else has she said?
Yeah, well, Sam Altman, who founded ChatGPT OpenAI, insinuated that the similarity was intentional, tweeting a single word, her, which is a reference to the film in which she voiced that chatbot. The actress said she'd been initially approached by Mr. Altman about voicing the new chatbot back in September, and that he had said that he felt that with her voicing the system, she could bridge the gap between tech companies and creatives and help consumers feel comfortable with the seismic shift concerning humans and AI. He said that her voice would be comforting to people. She eventually rejected the offer for personal reasons, but 2 days before the Sky chatbot was released, Mr. Altman apparently contacted her agent, urging Ms. Johansson to reconsider her initial refusal. Mr. Altman has since said that the company had not sought to imitate Ms. Johansson's voice. The voice of Sky is not Scarlett Johansson's, and it was never intended to resemble her, as he said.
Right. Suranjana, thank you very much. Suranjana Tiwari from our business desk.
Now, Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks, the website which published a huge number of leaked documents, has been told he can appeal against an extradition request from the United States. He was granted permission by the High Court in London to appeal against the order that he be sent to the US to stand trial for leaking military secrets in 2010 and 2011. The US argues that the WikiLeaks files, which disclosed information about the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, endangered lives. Well, Julian Assange has resisted extradition from the UK for more than a decade. And this week's decision means that he will be able to challenge American assurances over how his prospective trial would be conducted in the US. Well, on the line is the wife of the WikiLeaks founder, Stella Assange. Welcome to Newsday. What is your reaction to this ruling by the High Court?
Good morning. Well, it was a relief, but this is just a temporary reprieve. The case against Julian is a case that is an attack on journalism and news gathering. Julian was not the leaker. It was Chelsea Manning who sent these documents to WikiLeaks, and WikiLeaks just did what journalists do, which is review it and publish it.
And so you're saying then that his likely defence in an American trial would be using what, First Amendment rights in the United States, the right to the freedom of speech, and he'd be saying that he was merely publishing information that he'd been given.
Yes, Julian is being prosecuted under the 1917 Espionage Act. So this is a piece of legislation that has never been used in a news gathering context against a publisher before. This is unprecedented. It had been used against whistleblowers, Chelsea Manning, Edward Snowden, and so on. But the real difference in this case is that it has, for the very first time, been applied to the person who received the information and published it. So the bulk of the case is for receiving, possessing, and communicating information to the public. The thing about this piece of legislation is that it has no public interest defense. He cannot say what the documents contained, what the calculation was, and of course these documents revealed war crimes, evidence of torture, assassination squads, the gravest of international state-sponsored crimes, and of course this case therefore should never have been brought. The case yesterday in court turned on the United States' position that because he's an Australian national and because the alleged activities, the alleged crimes of possessing and communicating, publishing, took place outside of the United States, that he would not have access to the First Amendment when he's on trial in the United States. This is a constitutional protection that Americans would be able to invoke, but because he's a foreigner and he was abroad, then he would not have access to constitutional protections.
And so this will then be discussed at a further hearing in the UK. When might you know for certain whether he will be extradited or not?
Well, we simply don't know. In the past 5 months, we've had two hearings in which if he had lost, he would have been immediately processed for extradition, potentially within hours or a day. So it's been a very, very stressful ride. And all we have now, as I said, is a temporary reprieve, a permission from the High Court to be able to bring a full appeal in relation to the First Amendment, his access to the First Amendment at trial in the United States. This has gone on for over 5 years. He's been in a high security prison all this time.
He was in Belmarsh prison yesterday. He didn't go to the court for health reasons. How is he?
Well, he's under enormous pressure. That's right. He is not even able to come to his own crucial court hearing. I spoke to him in the morning and he hadn't slept all night. And in the week leading up to the hearing, he's been under a lot of stress. I spoke to him afterwards as well. And of course, he was relieved, but he's indefinitely detained in the harshest prison in the UK
and
for years.
Know whether and years. He'll remain in this country or not. And you have two children with him. Do they know that their father could be extradited?
No, they don't know anything about a potential US extradition. They're only 5 and 7 years old. They see him once a week. We go to the prison. And what I tell them is that we're fighting for Julian's freedom and millions of people around the world are fighting to free him, and that he will come home, and we talk about what we'll do when he's able to come home.
Well, thank you very much indeed for your time. That's Stella Assange there, the wife of the WikiLeaks founder, Julian Assange, who is still waiting to find out whether he will be extradited to the United States to stand trial. We are still watching pictures of the funeral of The Iranian president, Ibrahim Raisi, who was killed in a helicopter crash at the weekend. We'll be returning to our BBC Persian special correspondent in a moment as that funeral procession continues in the northwestern Iranian city of Tabriz. This is Newsday on the BBC World Service.
Distribution of the BBC World Service in the United States is made possible by American Public Media, producer and distributor of award-winning public radio content, engaging audiences, creating meaningful experiences, and fostering conversations. APM, American Public Media. With support from Ninja One, the endpoint management platform that automates the hardest parts of IT and helps your employees be more productive and secure no matter where they work, at ninjaone.com.
Campaigns and pundits are looking at swing states for a glimpse into what voters want. One state in particular has clues.
Wisconsin is the land of the nail biter.
Voices from two swing counties in a swing state. That's tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
That story, plus all the morning's news, beginning at 2 o'clock, running till 9 Tuesday morning. Morning Edition from NPR News on KQED Public Radio.
Hello, you're with Newsday from the BBC World Service with Sana Safi and Rob Young.
Iran pays tributes to President Ibrahim Raisi, who died in a helicopter crash. What next now?
Also, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has denounced an attempt to arrest him over Israel's conduct in Gaza.
And South Africa's highest court has barred former President Jacob Zuma from running for parliament in the next week's general election. But first, the news.
BBC News with David Harper. Human rights groups have expressed concern over a trial due to start in Greece involving nine Egyptian men accused of causing one of the biggest migrant shipwrecks in the Mediterranean Sea. More than 600 people perished. Six survivors have told the BBC the Greek Coast Guard caused their boat to capsize and then tried to cover it up. An investigation by leading news organisations has found that the EU is financing operations by North African governments to detain thousands of migrants and dump them in desert areas. Funeral ceremonies for the Iranian president Ebrahim Raisi are starting in the city of Tabriz, near the place where he died in a helicopter crash. The supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei will preside over the main ceremony in Tehran on Wednesday. Medical workers in Israel have told the BBC that Palestinian detainees from Gaza are routinely kept shackled to hospital beds blindfolded. The Israeli army says handcuffing of detainees in the Sadeh Tamar hospital is carried out in cases where the security risk requires it. The first of two Australian military planes has landed in New Caledonia to evacuate citizens stranded by violent unrest in the French Pacific Island territory. New Zealand has sent another. There's been a week of rioting sparked by electoral changes that are opposed by indigenous Kanak separatists. The alleged ringleaders of a far-right plot to overthrow the German government are due to go on trial in Frankfurt. They are linked to the so-called Reichsbürger movement that rejects the post-war German state. Donald Trump's Truth social media account has posted a video containing a reference to a unified Reich if he regains the White House in November. Reich, the German for empire, is commonly used to reference the Nazi Third Reich led by Adolf Hitler. Mexico's Environment Agency is investigating a spate of deaths among wild howler monkeys that's been linked to a severe heat wave in the southern states of Tabasco and Chiapas. And that's the latest BBC News.
Thanks very much indeed, David, for that summary of the news. Hello, you're with Newsday from the BBC World Service with Sana Safi and Rob Young. Coming up this half hour, we'll take you to South Africa, to Israel and to Iran, where the funeral procession is underway for the president, Ibrahim Raisi, who was killed in a helicopter crash on Sunday. We're watching images from the northwestern Iranian city of Tabriz, where thousands of people have filled the streets and have been listening to Islamic prayers. We'll head there for you shortly. Well, we're going to head to Iran now. We're going to listen in now onto the streets of the northwestern city of Tabriz, where that funeral procession is underway for the Iranian president, Ibrahim Raisi. Well, back with us is BBC Persian's special correspondent, Kazra Naji, who, if you were with us half an hour ago, you'd have heard also We've heard lots of speeches, I think. Is that right?
Yes.
We've been listening.
Yes, what we are getting are speeches now. I don't know who is speaking at the moment. They're talking about the crew and what they have been saying in the past about their efforts and their work with the president. Earlier, about 5 minutes ago, we saw a huge open truck driving into the area amongst the crowd and carrying the coffins of the 8 people who died in that incident.
Including the president.
Including the president. The president's coffin and the foreign minister and the Friday prayer leader of Tabriz are in the middle, and then the crew on the right-hand side and the others on the left-hand side.
So this was a low-load lorry bedecked with Iranian flags.
That's right.
All 8 coffins.
That's right. And
quite an unusual vehicle for a funeral procession.
Well, you know, these are impromptu sort of decisions that they make, and it looked as if it was being done by the Revolutionary Guards. On top of the truck, there were a number of Revolutionary Guard personnel standing over the coffin. So I suppose these are the last-minute arrangements that they have made. And obviously, a lot of people who are there, the supporters of President Raisi and the hardliners, they want to see the coffins, I suppose, and this is what has happened. As I said, this is an informal funeral today in Tabriz for the people there, and the main thing, main funeral, main ceremony, we are expecting to be held tomorrow in Tehran, which is tomorrow, Wednesday, is a national holiday, and we are expecting Iran's supreme leader, the top authority, to be attending and making a speech there.
We've just removed the sound from the city of Tabriz because Iranian television is now playing music over the top of the natural sound, which we're not going to broadcast. But that procession is continuing, and the TV has just been showing images of that lorry with those 8 coffins on driving through the streets and the people parting just ahead of its arrival. How long would you expect this funeral procession today to take?
I think it will be a couple of hours, perhaps, and then they will disperse the crowd. Interesting, watching the Iranian TV, state TV, it looks as if they are very keen to show that it's business as usual.
Also, very tight shots of the, what looks to me, very large crowd anyway. Are you surprised by the number of people who've turned out?
I'm not surprised, actually, because in previous occasions, there were evidence that a lot of these supporters are bused in. They are, or they are required to attend to this these ceremonies. Like, you know, if you're
so state employees would be given the day.
State employees, civil servants are required to attend, and then also in villages, they go and take the buses there and bring people for a day out in the big city, and so on and so forth. And the school kids, Revolutionary Guard, sort of off-duty people, the army types, they all are brought in to make the crowd, to give the impression that this that Iranians are rallying around the regime.
Because this part of the procession is in a very wide tree-lined avenue, and every square inch of it is taken up with people.
Absolutely. From what I'm seeing on the TV screen, we're talking about probably 10 or 20,000 people there already. What I was saying is that they are trying to project that it's business as usual in Iran, nothing is disrupted. Iranian parliament is holding its normal sessions, and the experts assembly has just opened its first session after the elections. So, and I'm surprised that these are happening at this point, which shows that the Iranian regime and the leaders are keen to show that nothing has been disrupted. The work of the government and the state is continuing as before.
Khazra Naji, BBC Persian Special Correspondent, thank you.
پرچم تا ابد رفت.
As you can hear, that funeral procession of Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi continues in the northwestern city of Tabriz.
We are staying in the Middle East. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has angrily condemned the International Criminal Court's prosecutor for seeking arrest warrants for him alongside Hamas's leaders over alleged war crimes in the Gaza conflict. Karim Khan, KC, said there were reasonable grounds to believe that all of them bore criminal responsibility for war crimes. Netanyahu also accused him of taking his place among the great anti-Semites of modern times. Hamas denounced what it said was an attempt to equate the victim with the executioner. Condemnation has also come from the American President Joe Biden. Mr. Biden was speaking at a Jewish American Heritage Month event at the White House.
We reject the ICC's application for arrest warrants against Israeli leaders. Whatever these warrants may imply, there is no equivalence between Israel and Hamas. And it's clear Israel wants to do all it can to ensure civilian protection. But let me be clear. Contrary to allegations against Israel made by the International Court of Justice, what's happening is not genocide. We reject that.
U.S. President Joe Biden there. To tell us more, we are joined by Israeli human rights lawyer Michael Safat. He joins us live from Tel Aviv. Thank you very much for being with us on Newsday. First of all, how do you react to the ICC's arrest warrant?
Well, this is a very grim and embarrassing day for Israel and for Israelis. But these arrest warrants or the request for arrest warrants were up and coming. Israel's own legal authorities have been failing for years in investigating and trying people, leaders, generals who are for their treatment of Palestinians. And the Gaza war has proven to be one where Israeli warfare methods and policies and practices have been absolutely horrendous. So I think this was something that was in the cards. I mean, of course, this is a challenging, the most challenging time for the ICC. It's the first time actually confronting a Western power, one that has a lot of allies that are very powerful. All the European Union members, the UK and Canada, Australia. So this is a very, very challenging act for the ICC.
The Israeli political leadership, as well as Prime Minister Netanyahu, have criticized this decision. They have denounced Mr. Khan, calling him the great anti-Semites of modern times. What do you make of this response?
Yeah, I mean, this is. I think that kind of a statement is a crime against the very sacred struggle against anti-Semitism. Israel has been using, the Israeli government has been exploiting the very important of fighting anti-Semitism in order to curtail, to suppress every kind of criticism of Israeli policies. And I think that would not help. It seems that Karim Khan, the prosecutor of the ICC, is not deterred by this kind of allegations. And they hide the fact that Israel has probably very poor defense to the merits. So this is, I think this is very outrageous that these kind of allegations are the answer.
Israel is not a member of the ICC, so legally, what bearing does the arrest warrant have?
Well, the ICC jurisdiction expands to territory of states that have that are members of the ICC. And in 2015, Palestine has asked to join the Rome Statute. It signed it and ratified it. And in 2021, a tribunal composed of three judges of the ICC has confirmed that as far as the Rome Statute, the constitution of the ICC is concerned, Palestine is indeed meets the criteria of a state. So any crime that is committed on Palestinian territory, or every crime that is committed by a Palestinian national, is under the jurisdiction of the court. And here we see the prosecutor implementing that decision by both charging Israelis who are responsible for alleged crimes in Palestinian territory, meaning in the Gaza, but also charging Palestinian leaders who have been committing crimes in Israeli territory, but they are Palestinian nationals, so the ICC jurisdiction applies to them.
Michael Svart, thank you very much for joining us on Newsday.
Let's head to South Africa now, where the country's highest court has barred the former president, Jacob Zuma, from running for parliament in next week's general election. The Constitutional Court ruled that his 15-month prison sentence for contempt of court disqualified him. He was jailed in 2021 for refusing to testify at an inquiry investigating corruption during his presidency. Now, Jacob Zuma was a member of the ruling African National Congress, the ANC, but he fell out with them and has been campaigning under the banner of the newly formed MK Party. Well, we're joined now by Phoebe Potgieter, who is a member of the ANC, also an elected member of South Africa's Parliament. Welcome to Newsday. What is your reaction to this ruling?
The ANC. It's a very important ruling for South Africa from a constitutional point of view. Our laws, electoral laws, say that anybody who's convicted for more than 12 months of a criminal offence may not stand as a public representative at any level. So the electoral court ruling was quite problematic, and that is why we supported the fact that the IEC took the matter to the Constitutional Court, which is the final court, the apex court in our country, to give legal clarity, because it's not just about Mr. Zuma, it's about any public representative that want to stand and have a criminal record. So we've got clarity now, and the ANC welcomes that.
It is about Mr. Zuma, though, with an election just days away, though. And
no, his it's not just about Mr. Zuma.
His party say that his image will remain on the ballot paper, so the people for the MK party will, in a sense, be voting for him, won't they?
Yes. So the ruling is twofold. The first one is that for any public person that want to contest as a public representative in South Africa, the law is clear, and our apex court, the Constitutional Court, has given clarity on that. So we've got clarity going forward. The second issue is that according to the electoral regulations, that the person whose face appears on the ballot paper is the leader of the party. Mr. Zuma has been registered as the leader of the party. So even though he may not represent the party in parliament, his name will appear on the ballot, which I think is a good thing, because it means that our elections administration is not delayed. We are about 8 days away from voting, and therefore the ballot papers can be printed and it's all systems go.
What's your expectation of what kind of support the ANC, your party, will get in the election next week?
Well, in 2019, the ANC got 57%. That's what we're aiming for, that we to move towards a 50%. There's, of course, been a lot of polls that say to the contrary.
Yeah, and Ipsos poll last month, you were at 40%.
But also most of the polls saying that we have been catching up quite a bit. So our target is to have an absolute majority, more than 50%. And we think that the ANC think that we will definitely be close to what we got in 2019, which is 57%.
Right. So you think you will still be able to govern as a majority, because there is the possibility, if the polls are to be believed, that you won't get a majority and therefore may need a party like MK to cobble together a government. Is that a possibility?
I mean, it's not over till it's over. The race is still on. We are 8 days before the elections. We are all out to make sure that we get the 12 million votes that we need in order to get close to the 57% that we got in 2019. and that is the aim. We will talk about unemployment, what happens after
the results. Given that unemployment is at 50% and that youth unemployment...
34%, the official unemployment is at 50%.
Can I ask the question? Given that youth unemployment is at 50% in South Africa, why should a young person vote for the ANC when you've had years and years to create jobs and haven't created a sufficient number of jobs?
Well, of course, that is part of the South African reality, that although on issues of the social wage, houses, education, health, the ANC has done well over the last 30 years. But in terms of economic transformation, we still have overt concentration. Black owners on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange is about, I think, less than 13%, et cetera, et cetera. So yes, the problem of unemployment and economic transformation is a major problem. And this is why the ANC has looked at investing in people. At the moment, 1.2 million students, poor students, are supported with free education. We're focusing on a jobs plan in our manifesto. We're focusing on industrial policy. I mean, we're talking about 30 years, but we are also talking, and you in the UK should know that, 342 years of colonialism and apartheid. And we think that the ANC has done well in the first 30 years. There have been mistakes, but we do think that South Africans can trust us to make sure that we transform the country and continue to create a better life for all South Africans.
Phoebe Potgieter, thanks very much indeed for joining us. Phoebe is an ANC member of South Africa's Parliament. We will, of course, be talking an awful lot more about those elections before polling day on the 29th. And you can find an in-depth series of reports about the South African elections online at bbcnews.com.
And now George Addo is here with all the latest sport headlines.
And let's begin with football. Arne Slot says the opportunity to work at one of the biggest clubs in the world was difficult to ignore as he was confirmed as Liverpool new manager following the departure of Jurgen Klopp. The Merseyside club agreed a compensation deal worth $11.4 billion with final in April for Slot, but only formally announced his appointment after the final match of the season. Dutch football reporter Marcel van der Kraan says one of Slot's strengths as a manager is to develop young talent.
He plays like Klopp, he puts the pressure game, he loves pressing football, he will develop players, he talks well, he has great communication, great man management, but understanding Liverpool as a football club, his English is great, I think, and that will help him much, much better than any other manager, and I hope he buys into that culture of English football.
Australia striker Sam Kerr has officially been ruled out of the 2024 Paris Olympics as he recovers from an anterior cruciate ligament tear. The 30-year-old was injured during a Chelsea training camp in January. She has scored 99 goals for the Blues and a further 64 for Australia, and has also been nominated for the top prize in women's football every year since its inception in 2018. Now, Andrew Parsons, the president of the International Paralympic Committee, has told the BBC he wants to see this summer Paralympic Games having a lasting legacy around the world. Parsons believes the Paris Games can have a big impact on disability rights.
What we would like to see is that this legacy will translate into a global legacy, not only in Paris, not only in France. We have seen some very good discussions and very good advancements in some other movements, you know, when it comes to gender, when it comes to ethnicity, sexual orientation, and we believe that persons with disability, they have been a little bit left behind. So the Paralympic Games is the platform, is the movement, is the moment where we can definitely put them back into those discussions at the highest level.
In tennis, Dominic Thiem beat Franco Agamenoni 3-6, 6-3, 6-2 in the first round of qualifying for the French Open in Paris. The former US Open champion will retire later this year, but needs to win two more matches to reach the main draw of the Grand Slam. In golf, Scottie Scheffler's court date has been delayed until the 3rd of June following his arrest during the US PGA Championship in Valhalla last week. A 27-year-old was arrested after trying to drive into the golf club in heavy traffic, and his arraignment date had been set for Tuesday, the 21st of May. And after nine NFL seasons, Philadelphia Eagles wide receiver Devante Parker has decided to retire at the age of 31. As much as he looked forward to time with the Eagles, Parker has resolved to spend more time with his family. He finished the NFL career with 369 catches for 5,266 yards and 27 touchdowns. And that's your sport for now.
In impressive. Thank you, George.
Yeah, George has got all the facts at his fingertips. Thanks very much indeed, George. We're going to head back to Iran now, to the northwest of the country, to the city of Tabriz, where the funeral procession of the president, Ibrahim Raisi, and seven others who were killed in that helicopter crash at the weekend is still underway. Thousands of people are now walking slowly, somberly through the streets of the city of Tabriz. Some are waving Iranian flags, others are holding portraits of the former president and also of the Ayatollah aloft. Earlier on we saw a lorry with eight coffins draped in Iranian flags driving down the middle of this tree-lined avenue where all of these people are walking. We're going to talk now to our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, about some of the issues that Ibrahim Raisi's death raises. Welcome to Newsday, Lise.
Yes, good morning.
We heard earlier on from BBC Persian special correspondent about the Iranian regime attempting to project strength and stability, which must be difficult at a time when two very senior figures have been killed in a helicopter accident and the succession for the top job appears to be in crisis.
Images, this is what they will hope to see, and what we are already seeing in Tabriz is the streets thronged with mourners, a throng which stretches street after street, people sobbing, collapsing in tears, clutching, trying to touch the caskets as they go by, the bodies of the eight people killed in the helicopter crash. These scenes are live on Iranian state television. They'll be all over social media. This is an opportune moment for Iran's ruling conservatives, not just to allow those who do want to grieve, but to send a message to Iran. And indeed, they know the world is watching, that Iran is united in its sorrow for its leaders who were killed in this accident. They are called martyrs. But Iran is together at this tragic moment. That is what they want to portray.
And yet we had people setting off fireworks in Tehran when they heard of the accident at the weekend, and some people taking to social media to mock the president in death.
Yes, more than four decades after the Iranian revolution of 1979, Iran is very, very much divided, a very angry country, and there were those scenes of celebration when the news broke that Ibrahim Raisi and seven others had been killed in this crash in the northwest, not far from where this first procession is now taking place. There were images on across social media of Iranians inside the country as well as in the diaspora dancing, celebrating, cursing Ibrahim Raisi, especially as we heard on the program earlier, those who lost loved ones either in the wave of executions of political prisoners in the 1980s when Ibrahim Raisi was a young prosecutor and was on what was called a death committee. He always said that he did not sign the warrants, but he was on that committee, and there has never been a proper investigation. There were also scenes of celebration by those who were injured, some losing eyes, losing limbs during the crackdown on the unprecedented protests in recent years, sparked by the death in custody of a young Kurdish Iranian woman. So there are very, very bad memories for and losses for many Iranians. So for them today, this is not a day of sorrow. It is a day of celebration. They will not be taking to the streets, but others will. And that is what the Iranian officials want to show.
And there are elections due in just over a month's time to choose a new president. Is there any word yet on who that is likely to be, given that we keep hearing that it will be the Ayatollah who will likely choose the winner?
This is a very carefully managed process in Iran, the election process. I covered Iranian elections on the ground when the BBC was allowed to report on elections inside the country in the 1990s, and there was exuberant participation, very strong turnout, more than 70%, when despite the restrictions which have always been there, there was a genuine choice from reformists and conservatives. What we saw in 2021, the election which brought Raisi to power, it was not left to chance. All of the pro-reform, even moderate conservatives, were excluded by what's called a guardian council, which scrutinizes all of those appropriate to run. They will not take any chances now. The moment is too critical.
Thank you.